This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a rebroadcast of an interview from earlier this year on the Green Dot program, which Kalamazoo College is using to try and prevent sexual assault and relationship violence. But first, in September, a Kalamazoo County jury found Calvin Kelly, a truck driver from Memphis, not guilty of rape. The case went back to 2008. Two recent stories in Bridge detail the efforts to get cases like this one to trial and why the authors say that DNA evidence still isn't enough to get a conviction. We're joined by the authors of those two Bridge stories, Wayne State University history professor Kadada Williams via Skype, and historian and author Danielle McGuire joins us by telephone. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
I want to begin with the headline on one of these stories. Say her name, Shawana Hall, she is a hero. And first of all, we should note that in cases of sexual assault or where an allegation of sexual assault has been named, we normally don't give the name of the person who was assaulted or made the accusation. This is a particular instance where Bridge said they decided to go ahead and use the name with the permission of the family. So let's start with that. Why are we saying her name?
So often in these cases where we're talking about marginalized women, they are almost entirely disappeared from these kinds of stories in general. When we talk about the Me Too moment, for example, we hear A-list actresses, Olympic gold medalists, largely well-known white women, and so often Black women and girls' stories and voices are disappeared from these kinds of public moments. So we wanted to give Shawana Hall some space, some recognition, and credit for everything that she did to bring her assailant to justice. And we also wanted to remind people that there are so many other women like her whose names are never said, whose stories never get told, and who are not believed.
So as you said, she had to step forward to get this case to trial. Give us an idea of why you use the word hero.
I think that one of the things that, and this is just to sort of fill in a little bit on one of Danielle's points, is that one of the things that happens when we talk about the discovery of the 11,000 rape kits in Detroit and throughout the state is that we focus on the kits, right? And we often lose sight of the fact that behind every single kit is a person, is a man, a woman, or child. And in this case, Shawana Hall was one of those people. And we're able to, or we're committed to sort of saying her name and telling her story, because what happens is that everyone focuses on the kids. They lose sight of the people behind them. And what this trial and the verdict and its aftermath show is how important it is for us to understand who these women are and all of the things they have to overcome and put themselves through in order to get their cases before a jury.
So as you said, you wanted to tell her story. Let's tell people a little bit about who Shawana Hall was before what happened in 2008.
Well, she grew up in the Midwest. You know, she was just an average Midwestern girl. She's part of a very large and extended family. She's the fourth of six children born to her mother, Rosetta Hall. She grew up in Kalamazoo, went to Lloyd Norris High School, and was really close with her siblings, particularly her baby sister, Talaya, who we spoke to. You know, they spent a lot of time together and shared a lot of events together, and their children were always together. We really got to know Shawana through Talaya. And I think what she expressed to us was just the enormous love that family had for her, how much they enjoyed spending time with her, that she was, you know, the life of the party, that all of the kids, the nieces, the nephews, everyone loved her, that she was the favorite aunt. They called her Monkey, Auntie Monkey. And Talaya told us that, you know, whenever she came around, all the kids would run and jump on her and hug her and celebrate her. And so, you know, that was just a little bit of what she told us. Maybe Kadada wants to share a little bit more.
You know, I think that in talking to the family, what we were able to see is her as a whole person, right?
Right.
Someone who was connected to a family, someone who was loved and who loved. And in talking to her family, what we learned is what the kidnapping and sexual assaults did to her. it just sent her into a really dark place and helped us understand just how much of a challenge it was for her to go forward within the legal process. You know, she had been done wrong, understandably, but she was terrified. She was worried about what would happen to her within the criminal justice system. She was worried that she was going to get beat up in the system. And I think that, again, that goes to the point that we're making in terms of trying to make sure we understand what happens when these cases go to trial and what happens to survivors and how we treat them in the system.
Right, like Shawana Hall's sister Talia told us that when the case was delayed at one point, right, they had, you know, Shawana had so much hope. The case was moving forward. It looked like they were getting somewhere. Two other survivors came forward and were willing to testify. These were women from out of state that the assistant attorney general had found and, you know, got them to be allowed to be part of this case. And, you know, so they're really looking forward to it. But one minor setback was a major setback for Shawana Hall. That was, her sister said it sent her into a tailspin in a way, right? Because it was a sign, it was a signal to her that maybe her assailant wasn't going to get justice, that maybe the system wasn't going to work for her. And so, you know, from the outside looking in, we might see a delay or some kind of setback in the justice system as not being such a big deal. But for a survivor, it was a really big deal. And that doubt, that delay really, I think, terrified her and made her less hopeful about the outcome. And, you know, in some ways, she was right. It did signal, at least, I think, a reluctance to bring in other witnesses to really believe these women that would ultimately bear out in the verdict.
And she had already been waiting a long time to get to trial in the first place. There was about 9 years between the first when she was assaulted on her 31st birthday and when it actually got to trial.
That's right. This was part of a cold case initiative. This initiative within the Attorney General's office specifically looked at cases that had been closed or unsolved. And so they went back in after, I think, 4 years. And then it took another 3 years just to come to trial.
But in the meantime, part of what they had started doing was getting more of the, working through more of the untested rape kit backlog. And it was through that process that they discovered that at least 10 other women had filed reports with police officers about rape. And they submitted themselves for forensic examinations. And when that DNA was run through the system of CODIS, a match came up for one man named Calvin Kelly.
And so then he goes on trial in Kalamazoo County, but the jury comes back with a verdict of not guilty. Why do you think that happened?
I think that part of what happened is that the jury, they did not believe the DNA evidence. They did not believe the prosecutor's case. They did not believe Shawana Hall and the other victims. They believed Calvin Ray Kelly. And we think that that happens because they did not see themselves or anyone they knew in those women because they were marginalized, because they struggled.
You know, this is something Kanata and I talked about a lot. And, you know, one of the ways we analogized it was, you know, when we think about police shootings, right? Americans can see video of police shooting unarmed victims, and they can still not see that those victims were killed without any kind of justification, right? They don't believe their own eyes. And in some ways, this is really similar. DNA evidence is supposed to be the most advanced technological tool we have to identify assailants. And it is the gold standard, right? You know, we had 11 reported cases in this trial, two women who were there with Shawana Hall. So three women, all from different states, who all submitted forensic exams, who reported it to the police, and who were willing to testify. I mean, the odds of that happening are just impossible, right? And so we really expected the jury would, I think, look at this case like it was a slam dunk, but they didn't. And Kanata's absolutely right. They could not see I mean, very simply, they could not see Shawana Hall as a legitimate victim. They couldn't see her as a legitimate victim, I think, because she's a woman of color, because she was poor, because she had a history of engaging in drug use. They couldn't see her as who was worthy of justice for those reasons. But they could see Calvin Ray Kelly, a man who 11 women in 4 different states accused of rape, as innocent. It's just kind of shocking. And so in lots of ways, I think Kadada and I both believe that our nation's history of racism and sexism, you know, is still working in the minds of the public in such a way that they could see this case and have all the evidence in front of them and still not get past the stereotype.
So there's kind of 3 things that came up there, and I don't know if there's a good way to divide them up, but race is certainly in there, gender is in there, and then there is status. As you mentioned, somebody poor. Is there any way of knowing for sure, maybe not for sure even, but is there any way of putting a good estimate on which of those things might have been more in the jurors' minds when they made this verdict?
Well, I think what we know is that they intersect, right? It's kind of hard to separate them out individually. They all come together. And in that way, what it says is that if you are from a certain background, then you are not seen as deserving of justice. What it says is that if you are a woman, if you are poor, and if you are of color, that you are unrapeable. And what that does is it communicates to sexual predators. And the thing is that like Calvin Ray Kelly was probably, he appears to have been very strategic in his predation. You know, not only in the victims he chose, but even how he presented himself to the jury. He played on his knowledge of the way society sees poor women of color as being more marginalized, as being seen as less worthy victims. And verdicts like this essentially go and tell other men that it is okay to continue to prey on women who are struggling in life and who are marginalized.
Just for a moment here, I want to throw something out, you know, I guess on the behalf of the jury in Kalamazoo County, and just ask, you know, you both followed this pretty closely. And of course, when a jury comes back with a verdict, they don't find somebody innocent, they find them not guilty. And the standard we have is beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you think there's any way of looking at this case if you step back and say, I suppose that a juror could look at X and Y and come to the conclusion that there was reasonable doubt about the crime?
I can't see that. You know, I suppose the fallback in any kind of sexual assault case is he said, she said, right? And I think, you know, people could look at this case in that way. But then when you add all the evidence, I mean, look, this is what we know. We know that most women who are sexually assaulted do not report it. We know that for women who do report it, many do not submit to a forensic exam, right? And so already you have 11 women, again, across 4 different states who have not only reported the crime to the police, but who have gone through the arduous and difficult process of doing a sexual assault kit. And this is an internal bodily forensic exam. It takes a few hours. It is not pleasant. You have already been traumatized, and then you have to submit to, you know, a search of your cavities. It's hard. So if you have 11 women in 4 different states who have done all of those things at great risk to themselves, because again, these are women who are marginal, who are vulnerable, who in some ways have been in and out of the legal system. You know, they have way more to lose than to gain by going through those processes. So if I'm a juror in that case, I have to look at that compared to what Calvin Ray Kelly said, which was just essentially that this was consensual. I mean, what woman, after a consensual act of sex, runs across a wet highway in the rain, jumps a fence, and flags down a police officer in the middle of the night? I just don't see it. And the fact that they could overlook all of that, you know, I think said to Kadada and I, you know, as historians of racial and sexualized violence, that they couldn't see her as a victim. They couldn't see her in pain in that way. And I think that has everything to do with our history.
Right. And I'd just like to add to that. They couldn't see her as someone who would be kidnapped and raped three times at three different points along 131.
U.S. 131 in Kalamazoo.
Yes.
Correct.
Shawana Hall has since passed away. Does her family believe that this verdict played some role in her death?
Absolutely. I think that they believe that the verdict sent her into a downward spiral, that whatever, you know, bright spot she had found, whatever progress she had made in her life, was, you know, flushed down the drain with this verdict. I mean, this verdict said to her that she was nobody, right? That she didn't deserve justice, that she didn't matter, that her life didn't matter, that her testimony didn't matter, and that her story didn't matter.
And I think that one of the things we have to keep in mind is that she felt that way throughout the entire trial. You know, she testified before the jury. She worried that they wouldn't believe her. There was a moment when her sister told us that there was a moment when the jury asked to see a replay of her testimony. And Shawana Hall said then, they don't believe me. They don't believe me. And, you know, she was understandably devastated by the verdict, by her confirmation of her worst fears, that she would survive what she did, that she would come forward, that she would put herself through that horrific process for something called justice, and they would not believe her. And in the end, they didn't.
And I think it's also important to note that, you know, the Attorney General's office does not devote the kind of attention, time, and money to cases that are shaky or, you know, are not without merit. And so, you know, the Attorney General's office, like, really believed that this was a worthy case. And I think they still do. And they brought forward a really strong case. This really came down to what's in the jurors' hearts and minds.
I want to read something that you wrote in one of the articles. We believe the heroic efforts to get all of Detroit's and Michigan's sexual assault kits tested is not the end, but the beginning of a longer, winding path towards something akin to justice. The 2009 discovery was, after all, a symptom of a deeper problem and a longer history. But I do have to ask, does the not guilty verdict in Shawana Hall's case do anything to slow down the progress which otherwise could be made on cold case investigations?
I don't think so. I think, you know, when we talk about this being part of a longer history, what we're referring to is the ways in which race and sex and class intersect and the ways in which those things intersect in a way that makes some lives matter more than others. And we see this throughout our justice system. And we see it throughout, you know, our everyday lives. So in some ways, what this tells us, what the verdict told us, is that there needs to be a lot more education about this history. And that even if we bring forward the strongest cases, if we have jurors who fall back on stereotypes or who have implicit biases or who just don't understand the long history behind, you know, these biases and stereotypes, then it won't matter how much DNA evidence we have, right? What we believe is that there needs to be a more added to this work, and that's sort of an educational component.
Historian and author Danielle McGuire spoke with us by phone. Kidada Williams is a history professor at Wayne State University, and she joined us via Skype. Thank you both for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Their articles for Bridge are called Raped and Left on the Road, She Said Me Too, Jurors Said No, Not You, and Say Her Name, Shawana Hall, She Is a Hero. Those stories can be found at bridgemi.com and through a link at wmuk.org.